on the record. So.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. I have these kind of jingled around in here.
I never know what to ask sometimes.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, last Friday night, I sat in that chair thinking I was meeting with you. I went down there Saturday morning. I was like, you know what? It's like 11:30. I was waiting. I was like, man, what the hell's going on? I came in here, checked my email, and realized it wasn't until today. So I sat up all Friday night trying to think, you know. The first question I want to ask you is, and I think a lot of people would like to know, what do you do when you're not dealing with whites? Or
well, I have another job.
Right, and that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
people would like to know, I think.
Oh, okay. And that's one reason why I'm not at White's Bar all the time. I'm at White's Bar every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I write a lot that goes on the White's Bar website and then in Review Magazine, too. But I work for Community Mental Health in Saginaw.
Okay.
I started out there 16 years ago and worked with developmentally disabled kids and adults. And I liked it. I thought I found my calling. But then I took a postgraduate program at U of M. I got my master's degree there, the undergrad at Michigan State. But the postgraduate program with Susan McDonough from Brown University and then from U of M. And it was an infant at-risk program, and it introduced me to the principles of infant mental health, a relationship-based psychotherapy. It's a very small field of psychotherapy created by Selma Freiberg in the mid-70s at U of M. And I dug it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it found me. You know, I came from an infant mental health family. We had problems. I had problems. And it found me. The healer needed to be healed. And so I started that process of becoming a therapist, and that was terrible in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of film to prove it.
Yeah.
But gradually I found my voice, and that became my calling, at least part of my calling. The other part mm-hmm. is White's Bar, which I feel very connected to,
mm-hmm.
with my grandfather and my father. So I'm lucky in that I found a couple things that really mean a lot to me.
Right.
To find who I am.
Well, that kind of leads into my second question, which basically I would like you to just kind of run down briefly the history of White's Bar. Didn't it open in 1937, 1936?
Yeah, in June 30. Well, it actually had been the State and Bay Tavern.
State and Bay Tavern?
State and Bay Tavern. That was the original name, and my grandpa kept that for a few years. But after Prohibition ended, mm-hmm. before Prohibition, it had been Ice Cream Parlor and all kinds of things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it had been several things. I'm trying to remember. My grandma, Nana, mm-hmm. worked for the fellow that owned the State and Bay Tavern.
Okay.
He had it for a couple, two, 3 years, right after Prohibition, so like 33, 34, up to the time my grandpa bought the bar in 1937. Grandma worked there, and grandpa worked at the, first the railroad, but he worked in one of the shops in Saginaw, and it was very polluted, and he had a bad case of asthma. Hmm. So in his wisdom, he went from a polluted plant to a smoky
right.
bar. He changed the name to White's Bar after a few years. It was just a beer and wine.
Mm-hmm.
Also sold gum, tobacco, Hershey bars. The GIs coming back from World War II were kind of hooked on a few things. Beer was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Hershey bars was another.
Sweets.
And so we sold a ton of candy bars, even through the 70s and 80s. I'd buy boxes of candy bars. And the vets would drink Blatt's beer and eat a Hershey bar.
Wow.
But anyway, so Grandpa... and we were just a... beer and wine. We had pop. We cooled things off with dry ice. I believe we got liquor in 1947. And so that changed things a bit. So suddenly there's whiskey and stuff. And Grandpa did well. That was a time when, he actually, you know that little back room where there's storage?
Right.
Where you put equipment?
Yeah.
That's where my grandparents lived.
Oh, really?
And they would, they had a stove there, and they would cook dinners for the customers right out of there.
Oh, wow.
And then walk through those doors and serve the customers.
So they had dinners, and more or less kind of like one meal a night type thing? Or
well, I'm a little unclear about that, but I know they had dinners, and they would they'd serve them to the customers. And it was all homemade dinners made by Nana, who was a good cook. She was a good cook. And what that gets to is, in that day and age, there wasn't these punitive laws, public health laws, drunk driving laws, and so on. And nobody ever got sick, but we sold dinners, or Grandma sold dinners, and the taxes weren't so high. The draft beer was like a nickel, bottled beer, 15 cents. And they made enough money that after a while, they would go spend winters in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot more money to be had then.
Right.
Now, White Spark doesn't nearly bring in the profit that my grandfather did, nor my father. But with each succeeding generation, the laws became more punitive, the taxes and licenses became more expensive.
Right.
And so it cut in on the ability to make money. And the product itself, the brewers raise their prices every year, and the liquor vendors, they'll change their prices, raise and lower prices, and if you don't keep on top of it, you just don't know, and suddenly you're charging way too, not enough for some of these brands.
And it creates a problem of, because the demand for drinking will always be there, and it never goes away. So they don't really have much to lose by raising it a nickel here and there, and by the end of the year, so that's not going to go away.
Well, on top of that, though, what we also know is the percentage of drinkers that go to public establishments have gone way down. The percentage has flipped. It used to be something like 75% of drinkers drank in bars.
Right.
Now it's 75% of the drinkers drink at home, or more. Because of the punitive laws, the way that, it induces some fear in people, and they don't want to lose their driver license or their job,
right?
So they stay inside, but and feed whatever addiction they have. Where my belief is, people should be drinking together in public, whether it's coffee or beer. I mean, there's nothing wrong with alcohol as long as you don't drink too much of it,
right?
But by joining together, then we assemble, we talk, talk about what's going on around us, we figure things out, and by this punitive, the nature of this punitive society, culture, we become more separate, and we know less, and we don't communicate with each other as well.
Yeah, I have a question written down here somewhere, but more or less deals with, White's Bar is not really a place that you think of to just go drink. It's probably the only bar in Saginaw, at least that I know of. Well, there's probably a couple that I know of, but not firsthand, where you go to knowing that you're going to have a conversation, knowing that there's going to be more than beer and cheer involved.
That's what I hoped for.
Well, that's what it's got. And what do you talk about that for a minute? Was that by design, A and B? How do you maintain it?
It is. I was hoping the emphasis would be less on drinking copious amounts, just a lot of beer.
That still happens, but...
But it still happens. I know what I'm dealing with. I don't like to create a forum for misery.
Mm-hmm.
What I was hoping is that White's could be a place where artists and musicians and people could gather together and have thoughtful conversations and enjoy one another, enjoy music and the arts, and it's something I always hope for. I think sometimes it works that way.
I think it does for the most part. I mean, the crowd at White's Bar is, everyone knows each other. You know, you have that kind
great.
Of, yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, when I go there, when I sit at the bar, usually it's in the evening, and then the whole different crowd is shuffled in. You know, the Ortegas and the Martys are all gone, and you know,
yeah.
Not that I don't have any. I get along fine with Marty.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean. The crowd shifts. And I go in there and I know half the people there.
Yeah.
And they go there for that reason.
That's the way it was, you know, in back, like in my father's time, mm-hmm. he became a Shriner. And so it was called like a Shriner's Bar, but everybody knew each other. And within that culture, they felt very comfortable.
Right.
And they were solving the world's problems. They talked about things that were going on. In my grandpa's day, it was very similar. We had this guy. He was in high demand as a projectionist for the movie theaters, like mm-hmm. Daniel's Theater next door and the Temple Theater and Franklin and so forth. He was in big demand. His name was Angelo Lorenzo. And he had huge hits. He wrote Sleepy Time Gal. And he'd get a group going. He'd blow his harmonica and they'd do sing-alongs. And it was another situation where people knew one another. They were connected. And they had a ball.
Mm-hmm. So, let me write his name down.
But yeah, he had several hits.
That's just how it sounds, Angelo.
Yeah, and it might go as Ange, A-N-G-E, Lorenzo, L-O-R-E-N-Z-O, something. Lorenzo.
Right.
If you Google him, you'll find him. And we even have this sheet music to Sleepy Time Gal in the Women's Bathroom. It's pasted there.
Talk about some of the groups. Talk about some of the groups that have been playing there the longest. Once in a while you have like a kind of a special bill, and it'll be like a band that's been playing there for 30 years or something. One of the Frost guitar players last summer was there.
Well, like Donnie Hartman, who you know I've known for a lot of years now, and I got to know him really. When I was young, I went to see the Frost, and they were an important band to me. With Scott Seeberger, who's the director of Delta's radio station now, he worked for Dow Corning when he and I kind of hooked up. We hooked up over support of Dick Wagner. And we did the Remember the Child project at SVSU back in 1994.
Oh, was that that? I was friends with Barry Rankin's son.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were real close. And I remember I had my little shirt. I was like running around doing stuff for him. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And Barry's a photographer. And Scott and I became friendly. He very nice guy, record collector, loves music. So we decided to put a concert on at the Civic Center. And it was the Frost with Cub Coda. And it, and I booked the date. It happened to be the finals, NCAA finals, and Michigan State was in it.
Oh.
And so we didn't stand a chance because, that's one of the biggest sporting events of the year, and Michigan State was in it. But it was a good experience for us anyway, and we talked about putting together other shows with combining the Turtles with Tommy James and doing a New Year's show. With Scott's vision that he's doing Moni Moni at midnight, but and so there's people like Donnie Hartman, Johnny Krogman has played there for years and came back for a while, and Zydeco Ziggy from White Crow, he's another just great talented musician, plays a lot of unique instruments, and he's a student of music. Mm-hmm. He's back playing, and so there is kind of the circle, and there's people coming back, and maybe August just played at White's on Thursday. I love them. So there's that kind of thing happening where some of the bands that help the Night Spar get accustomed to live music, that, and then the new bands.
What bands in the last, you know, 10, 15 years that have come through have really gone on to do some big stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. Gosh.
Or came from big stuff and played and wanted to play Whites.
Well, we had some. Kim Wilson, the singer for the Fabulous Thunderbirds, played White Spar about three times. Pete Best, original Beatles, played Whites. Lawrence Juber from Wings played Whites. We have Denny Lane from Blues and Wings coming in March 10th.
Sinclair, was that the first time he'd been in?
Oh, John Sinclair, yeah. He's played Whites about four times, and we kind of became friendly, if that really does happen. But we got along real well, and he liked the way I wrote about his stuff. I wrote an article or two with him, interviewed him. John is just a peace and love guy. I really mm-hmm. like him. He moved to Amsterdam, and he says, "Bo, the reason I went there is because the cops don't carry guns, and they don't care if I get high."
Right.
And I remember the first time he brought his daughter, Sunny, and she was pregnant, and I took him to his hotel room, and He's a free spirit. He's taken off his shirt in front of me, and I'm going, "Well, maybe I should leave and give you privacy." But he's just a great guy.
Yeah, it was cool playing or opening up for him, or we actually closed out for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want him back. I it's about time I call him again.
Part of what's cool about the bar is the proximity between the bands and the people.
Oh, yeah.
Is that by design, or has it just been that way? Because it's just has been that way. I mean,
well, the space was so limited. And when I first started this, inside, we did outdoor shows before we did indoor. People didn't think it could work. The staff mm-hmm. didn't get nobody, and the staff is we don't have the same staff anymore. But nobody got behind it, and so that delayed it for a while because I just couldn't get people behind it. But I had a vision that it could work, and it came kind of from John Krogman, who said, you know, he goes into some of these clubs in Detroit and they're like White's Bar or CBG.
Yeah.
It's kind of like White's Bar, and so I said, okay, I'm going to try it then. And originally there was no stage,
mm-hmm.
and Dick Wagner was playing, and Dick is an icon. Frost, Alice Cooper, and all that. He played a few times, and then he came to me one day and he says, "Bo, you know, it would be nice to have a little stage up there."
And then it was just the drum riser, right? Just that one little square.
That one little square, and that's what I put in there. And I called it Wagner's Auditorium because Dick was the one who said, "Why don't you put this up?" And I was going to get a wood block letters up Wagner's Auditorium, but I never did it. And people were so helpful. Like Dick gave me some advice about things, and he told me at the time too, "Bo, you need to be here, and you need to introduce the bands." I didn't want to hear me introduce the band, and so I started doing that for a while.
Uh-huh. MC.
Yeah, kind of MC, and I was more comfortable doing it outside than inside. But
did you ever go back to that?
I don't know. I don't think people. I mean, there's a time when I go on and on, and I'd tell a story about I was in all these groups from the '60s. They're all studio groups, you know, like the Third Floor Elevators, the Monkees, and all that. And there'd be a band behind me, and I'd say, "Well, you know, I was Davey. He was Michael, and all the rest of the guys are all Peters." You know, and I'd go on and on saying silly stuff. And my wife, it was either my wife or my mother, came up to me and said, "Bo, you know, it's kind of funny, but I think you're talking too much.
Time to stop."
Yeah.
So you played. You played in music? You played music yourself?
Well,
because that's if you did, that's something that would be new to everyone.
Well, I took drum lessons from Bill Kemp. He was a child prodigy. By the time I met him, he's like this old guy who smoked a pipe. You know? I was maybe 12 years old. And so I was taking these drum lessons, and he kind of knew what he was doing. I wanted to play rock and roll, and he wasn't teaching me rock and roll. He was just basic rudimentary stuff. And I was not good. I didn't have good wrists or anything. And he'd get mad at me. If I didn't do the homework, you either do the homework or you're out of here. I'll kick you out of here. You're not going to be my student. So it came to pass I wasn't a student anymore. And I played drums and timpani and stuff for the North School band. And Dick Coughlin, who was a drummer for the Cherry Slush, he and I were in the band together at North School. But I was not a good drummer. And I remember once my brother, who actually could sing and a guitarist, he was trying to put a band together and had me as a drummer. And we were playing at somebody's house, and I wasn't good. And then number two, they put a mic up to me to see if I could sing. And then I couldn't sing. And so I was out of that group, too. So I'm not a musician.
I'm going to pause this really quick. Talk about, I guess, maybe if you have some memorable experiences from Whites that you want to briefly... There's got to be one or two in there.
Well, let's see. Because I've been there all my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, one experience was... it's not too personal, really, but a 67 snowstorm. And it was huge. There was a lot of snow, and it was drifting snow. And the bar was completely encapsulated in snow, front and back. I mean, it went right up to the roof, front and back. And we had to tunnel in. And we lived on Carolina Street, so we just walked. My dad, my brother and I, and I think my mom, my sister. And we walked to the bar, tunneled in, tunneled out, got it all, you know. There was no snow plow. It was back in those days, it was a gravel parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And next door was Daniel's Den. And there was no fence between us. But we got it shoveled out, and it was packed that day. It was truly a neighborhood bar. It was just jammed. And it was a type of snowfall that shut everything down.
Uh-huh.
Except White's Bar.
Yeah, right.
And so that was cool. I think highlights for me when I was younger is White's Bar had knothole teams, and we won a championship in each 11, 13, 15 under. That was cool. I made a lot of friends, some of whom we still kind of connect and email.
Well, let me ask you, let me kind of move away from the bar for a second.
Okay.
We'll talk about what you think. Well, I know that, you know, that you have some idea that music is instrumental in affecting some sort of change on a social level.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. What have you done actively? And just talk about, you know, music being a tool and affecting some sort of change.
Like a catalyst. Because I kind of believe that. And growing up with the zeitgeist of the 60s and believing the messages I heard from some of the bands I loved, you know, whether the Beatles or the Moody Blues, the Stones, Beach Boys, that there was a different way. And at the time, that was big for me because in high school, I was, I think they would call it a jock. And so I played sports, and that was kind of my emphasis. But at the very same time, I loved music, and gradually, I let go of sports. And well, maybe not so gradually. By the time I got to college in 1970, I was really looking for another way of being, a kind of a. Like a counterculture kind of approach. And then I got turned on to things like mind-altering kind of things. And I believe in altering one's consciousness, but for me, in this day and age, not so much not drugs or alcohol, but it's like exercise, sleep, meditation, prayer, music. But at that time, we're doing things like doing some acid and marijuana and with music playing. And it's like acid doesn't bring you any... How can I put this? I mean, the revelation you get through acid is you know yourself a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been plenty of experiments, Harvard and you know, Timothy Leary's experiments, and of course the CIA mind control stuff.
Right.
And they found that they couldn't use it because they couldn't predict what that would do, because it depends on what's inside of you at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the combination of music and some of the things I was experimenting with at the time led me to that down that road of I'm going to learn about myself more. I know myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't happen right away. It took a long time.
Right.
What was the question?
The question was, well, that, we went to a good place with that, but you know, what do you music? You know, there wasn't really a question. I was just putting in the idea of music as a tool to affect some sort of change. You know, I guess specifically thinking about White's Bar. I mean, the music that's come through, and what have you done? How have you used it as a tool in that regard? For instance, you know, did the Dick Wagner Remember the Child thing, and you've done that kind of thing in the past, and more than that.
I think music is a powerful catalyst for gathering people together in pursuit of something that's honorable. Like Remember the Child, a project to address the issue of child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And to shine a light on that so people are more aware and we can do something about it. We've done other benefits through the years. We're going to do one for Covenant. That's coming up pretty soon. It has to do with children, child welfare, and health. There's a Haiti relief.
Mm-hmm.
Benefit Ruthie from Templar Limbs is in charge of that. So I think music can be part of that soundtrack of change and doing things that are life affirming and honorable and helpful.
Right.
In terms of the music I bring in, it's like I don't think of it quite along those lines. It's like I put a barbershop quartet in once because I thought they harmonized well.
Right.
But if I don't care what genre it is, if I try to listen to all the CDs that are sent to me and go online and listen to the music online or on MySpace, if I like it, I'll book it.
Right.
It doesn't matter what it is.
Mm-hmm. It's a matter of...
And so I don't know, the way I approach it, it's maybe it's like a Bill Graham kind of deal where he put some odd bands
that
didn't seem to click musically, but it introduced different genres to the crowd. And so I was kind of thinking along those lines that I'll just bring different types of bands in that are good and see what happens. Sometimes it works and sometimes
it
doesn't.
So, what have you ever? So you've been the proprietor since 1984. Okay. Any time between 1984 and now that you thought about just getting out of the business?
Well, yeah, because it's been tough, and there's been times where I had personal problems and didn't quite know what to do. Sometimes financial problems. I made mistakes and paid for them. And so there was one time in particular got really rough for me, and I actually approached a realtor about selling Lensbar.
Mm-hmm.
And was put up for sale. for about a week.
And then you say, what am I doing?
Yeah, what am I doing? No, this is my heritage. This is part of my identity. And it's honorable. The mistakes I made are the mistakes of youth. I'm only human. And it doesn't mean I'm not worthwhile. It doesn't mean that white scar isn't worthwhile. Just mistakes are made. And so I weathered some of those storms. I'm glad I did. I mean, any job I've ever had is... Well, I haven't had too many jobs, but there's moments where you go, well, what am I doing?
What about... Have you ever thought about moving to a bigger space where you could have a big stage and you could fill the place with more people? I mean, have you ever thought of that?
I have, and next door used to be Daniel's Den.
Which side? On the corner, or...?
Going east. It's where a charter is now.
Okay.
And they tore that down.
What was Daniel's Den?
It was a nightclub. And all the Michigan rock bands were there. I saw Bob Seger there, SRC, Ted Nugent,
oh, wow.
Dukes. I saw... The Birds, the original Birds.
So in effect, you took over the whole, what was happening at Daniel's Den. When did they tear that down?
It was quite a few years ago. I can't remember the exact year. It had quit being a touchstone for good music long ago. The original Daniel's Den ended in about 1970. And that was their absolute heyday. But by 1970, things had changed. The freshness, in 1964 and 5, anybody that was playing rock and roll, I mean, there's people lined up around the block at the Village Pump, Daniel's Den, wherever there was live music. It was so fresh, and people were just, you know, bonkers over it. By 1970, it had changed, and there's this DJ out of Flint. God, I forget his name. He wrote a book, a DJ. And he talked about how after 1970, things had changed, and people quit attending shows, bands they didn't know. And so that already started in 1970. Now it's just one of the things that happened. At White's, if somebody doesn't know the name of a band, or a band's from Detroit or out of town, and they don't know them, people tend not to come in, and they miss some great shows.
That's one of the things I talked about with Kim in his interview, was, you know, he made that point when the Mongrels started out. People would come and see them even though they didn't know, because they knew Tim, and they knew Marks, and they knew Shane, and their faces that people knew in the community. So they'd come to see them. And he's, you know, he made the point too that, you know, a lot of these bands just play, they don't go see anybody else play. They don't hang out at the bars. And they just show up and they expect people to come see them play, and no one comes to see them play because they don't make friends in the community. And
yeah, I think you have to become part of the community, be embedded in the arts and music, and be there and exchange ideas. I think you're absolutely right. That's what I hope happens for all of us. It's like in community mental health. We need to be embedded in the community. We need to, it's like community organization stuff.
Right.
We're with people, not just at this edifice.
No, they can't just come to you and say, I got a problem, help me fix it. You have to know their problem firsthand. You have to be aware of what it's like to be in their shoes.
I agree. Absolutely.
You see that at White's a lot. I'll go in there any given night. Tim's playing. Don Zazula's sitting there. Marks might be there.
Yeah.
You know, half the people in there have played or play. You know, and then you have people like Cliff, like CD, you know?
Absolutely.
And he's
I've known him for a lot of years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Blues Creators.
Is he with them?
He had been.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is hell of a singer.
Yep.
I have a couple silly questions. Are you a Star Trek fan?
I was. The original Star Trek, I watched it at the time it was released, and I wouldn't miss it. I loved it. And I didn't notice... who's Captain Kirk?
Shatner.
Shatner. I didn't know he was overacting.
No.
Yeah. I didn't know he's a scene stealer. But
I never noticed it, to be honest. I love it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I'm still a fan. The new Star Trek stuff, I never watched too closely. Didn't mean to ignore it, but I just...
Right. Try to be specific in answering this. You know, 2008, we saw a lot of bankers get a lot of money. And, you know, ostensibly, the people who created the problem are put right back in power. And they're given the reins and said, fix it. The ones who created the problem. And we're seeing it. We've seen it, you know, in Saginaw. People say, you know, the economy's bad. Well, things took a turn for the worse in 2008. But this is Saginaw, and since 2003, this has been one of the most economically depressed small cities in the United States.
Yes.
But we're talking even in the 80s, things started to take a real turn for the worse.
Yeah.
So what, if anything, have you seen some direct impacts from this current, quote-unquote, economic downturn? Have you really seen anything, or is it just so messed up in Saginaw that it's...
It's certainly messed up, and a lot of the families I work with are impoverished and living hand to mouth, and they get very little. I think there's a cruelty there, a greed in our government. You know, it makes me wonder the legitimacy of it all. But stimulus to Goldman Sachs when Goldman Sachs is in charge of the Treasury, mm-hmm. I don't like it. And we could take that money. It's all our money.
Right.
And from my point of view, it's like risk has always been socialized and the profit has been privatized. And so you get those creeps from Goldman Sachs using our money to give themselves bonuses after they destroy the economy, and the Secretary of the Treasury is a Goldman Sachs alumni. It makes me mad. And the fallout is there's real people being hurt, and the Saginaw's community is troubled by all that. There's like an underclass of poverty that it's not changing.
Mm-hmm.
And the people living in Saginaw, the impoverished people, what I found is they're by and large pretty honorable people.
Mm-hmm.
There's one time I was going to this neighborhood that was declined, and there's an American flag on the porch. And I thought, oh my God, that's incredible. You know, and I in the winter, I remember driving, I had a van at the time. And the heater was out, and I was cold, and I was mad about it. And I saw this fellow riding his bike in the dead of winter. And I thought, geez, I think I saw the face of God or something. This is way too honorable. Like, I thought, this guy's probably going to work.
Right, or picking somebody, or going to do something for someone.
Yeah. And so I'm pretty upset by the way the government's run right now, and the almost planned, the socially engineered stuff where there's a permanent class that's forgotten, middle class being dismantled, and the wealthy and the elite, they're the ones, educated elite, wealthy, they're the ones screwing it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a banker's world right
banker's
now.
Banker's insurance. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like the President Obama puts these restrictions on the credit card companies and then gives them 6 months for them to fuck us.
You know?
It's like, wait a second. Now I have a credit card that has a 30% interest. That's loan sharking. Legal loan sharking.
What I noticed is that really people, you know, you don't hear people talking about the economic downturn or the way things are right now in Saginaw, because things have been fucked up around here for a long time, way longer than since 2008.
A long time.
I go to Boston twice a year, and people are talking about, well, maybe next year when the economy gets better. I'm like, people are, first of all, I mean, look around you, you know, and I mean, there's poverty and crime and gangs and bums in Boston, but it's a different it's a different thing.
You know, I went to Boston. It was the first Beatles convention, 1976 or something like that, 75. And I went with a friend, a couple friends. One was Risty Ciaselli. There was a book by Clinton Highline, Bootleg. And it features Risty, though they don't mention it because he was this huge bootlegger. All these wonderful bootleg albums, color covers, the Bob Dylan's Ten of Swords. It was like 10 albums. But anyway, we go to a Beatles convention, and we're walking around Boston. Now, I don't remember exactly where we were, but we were walking in some pretty nice areas, and then a block later, we're in this impoverished, messed up neighborhood. You know, so it was that close in that part of Boston.
You get that here in Saginaw, too. I mean, on the way to get cigarettes here, you know, you get gunshots across the river, and in the summer I heard gunshots just right across on Court Street here, like 3-4 nights in a row. But yeah, and then you go just down Hamilton this way, and there it looks like there's, how you know, it just looks, there's blown up and empty houses just four blocks down the road on Hamilton. Yes. And then you have Old Town, which is supposed to be the nucleus of if things going to change. They say it'll happen here, but
I mean, I think the city fathers, the people, the shakers and movers have a good idea in creating something very nice in the city of Saginaw, but you can't neglect the neighborhoods.
Right.
Where people actually live and try to survive.
Yeah. What, I gotta ask this, what do you see yourself doing in 10 years, and what do you see the bar doing in 10 years?
Well, 70 is the new 60, so I'm still gonna be working.
That's right.
I hope to work for at least another 6 years or so at Community Mental Health. White's Bar, what I want it to survive, so I think my daughter and Tim will take that over. But, you know, maybe I'll bartend for them or something on a Sunday.
All right.
But I'd like that to happen. And Christy, my daughter, knows music real well, and she knows the bar, and Tim, of course, does as well. So I think there's potential that it keeps going.
Mm-hmm. He mentioned to me that he was going to be doing some booking.
Yes.
So that's good.
I got to give him this thing here. Because, I think other people besides me have a better idea of what's going on. I've always been the type of guy that stands on the outside and kind of looks in. And I need a little help with that. So somebody like Tim, who was really a big part of the scene and knew people, knew all the bands. Mm-hmm. I mean, there'd be a band come in and play White's Bar and say, "This is a fucking great band." Mm-hmm. He did that with Color World, I Became the Sky. I didn't know anything about them, but because of Tim, they got booked. Mm-hmm. And there's other bands that were booked because of Tim, because he had heard them and knew about them and said, "These people are good."
Yeah. And the thing about Tim, too, is that, you know, I've been friends with him. We were best friends in high school.
That's what he told me.
I've known him for so long. You know, intimately, we're really close. Jesse and I and him were really, like, the three inseparable people. And a couple weeks ago, she made the comment, something like, this is all not going to be included, but she said, he never gets mad. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I said, you know what? He doesn't. He's never, ever gotten mad at me or anyone. Ever.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Well, there's probably some repercussion, but it's amazing virtue or trait or whatever it is to never get mad. Mm-hmm. I've never seen him mad. I'm sure he has in his personal life. We haven't been close in the last several years, but I've never seen him that way.
I mean, he's so clever. I think, Tim does, because he has a wicked sense of humor. He could use humor to diffuse some of the other kind of emotions.
Yeah.
He's really clever with stuff. I've quoted him before, and I've used some of his words in some of my articles.
Why do bands want to play at White's? I mean, I'm talking about national and regional acts that call you up, email you, saying, we want to play your smoky little bar and for peanuts, more or less.
Yeah.
Why does that keep happening?
We've been at it long enough. We have a reputation, and I think it's a good one. And that's what I hear from people in different parts of the country. I'll get a postcard from bands that played here and say, geez, thanks a lot. A band from Brazil. And they want to come back. Bands like the Buzzards out of New York, a rockabilly band, Reno Divorce, a great punk band, they want to come back. I mean, they want to come back. They know what White's Bar is all like, all about. They like it. They like the idea that customers know why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
They're there to listen to music, and a lot of the bands experience something different, where people don't care, and they're talking and shouting and laughing and doing everything but listen to the music. So I think it's because the people that come in really appreciate live original music, and the bands know that.
Right.
And it does something for them.
Yeah, that's something I've always told people is, you know, even though it's a small place and you're not going to make a lot of money, it'll be one of the best shows that you play on your little tour, because people don't come to the crowd there in the evening. They come there; they're there to see music. Period. You know, they don't. If you turned off the spigot, you know, and stopped pouring drinks, they would stay there and watch the music. Uh-huh. They'd be a little upset, but they'd stay there and watch the music. And even if they are talking amongst themselves, when the song ends, everyone's clapping, you know, because they appreciate
it. Should be.
So that's pretty cool.
And, you know, and it's a nice... And this is what I'm told by some bands that there's been live recordings at White's Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And they sound good. And I just got another band that says they want to come back and do a live recording. Shadowhawk is from the Cherokee Nation. It's the Broken Arrow Blues Band. Shadowhawk says, he played there just once, just recently. I love the sound in there. This would be a perfect place to do a live album. And I said, well, yes, it would be. So they're going to come back and record a live album.
It does have good, it's conducive to good recording.
Yeah.
I've done a few with three or four different bands I played with there, and they always come out good.
Oh, I'd like to have copies.
Yeah, I've got some somewhere.
I'd love to hear that.
I'll make you a little mix.
Oh, great, great.
Well, I guess my last question will be, what has been the most rewarding thing about running White's Bar?
Wow, it's I think living up to a family heritage. It anchors me, not just to the community, but I think it's more than that. It's where I really feel connected to my father and grandfather, my parents and grandparents. And that wasn't always the case. I was kind of a hyper kid, so, you know, I got into some trouble. We had some rough times, parent, child. But, you know, they passed away, and yet they're still with me. And I found that I love them even more.
Mm-hmm.
And so keeping White's Bar is like keeping a pact with my elders.
Is there anything you want to add as an addendum to the interview?
Well, it's nice talking with you.
Yeah, it's cool.
I want to book a few shows.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We covered a lot of ground. I don't think I answered the questions real well.
Well, sometimes not answering the question is good in itself. You know, you get something else. You know, where the person goes from the prompt tells you something about the person, too.
No, sure.
You know?
Never know what I'm going to say.
Yeah, I didn't use half of these questions. you know, because you ask one, you go somewhere and you kind of go off of the, you know, the tree grows its own limbs.
Yes, yes.
Cool, I think I got plenty there because I had a, it's about an hour long. Go ahead.
Some bands that Kurt. Celebrity Torres band. It's a unique band in the great guitarist Ray Torres. It's just a band that needs deserves more recognition. And not about you, but I believe that. And then I love the Tossed Pints because they're they're dialectic. They're spiritual and they're funky. They're just unique. Don Sisula is, I think, in some ways a genius. I just like his stuff. And what I thought about them a long time ago, I told them this, is that they should be playing all the time, not just for St. Patrick's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of, they are. And yeah. They should be. They need to be heard. And I think the new album kind of clarified that, so it's not just related to ancient, you know,
right,
Gaelic and, you know, music. It's rock and roll punk. And,
you know, it's very pared down Irish punk.
Yeah.
You know, there's no flair at all, and the songwriting's outstanding too.
Yes,
they seem like they're steeped in that type of music.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so many good. I like John Vasquez. I like the acoustic music, and he has a different kind of voice. It's not a pure voice, but it's a voice that stands out. And so I think he's got something there. People tend to like him. And, he has fans. I grieve the loss of Sprout.
Mm-hmm.
I wish they would continue. Because I think Aaron Johnson, just like his brother, is a genius. He just writes great music. He's a wonderful instrumentalist.
They can still come see him on Sunday, at least.
Yeah, as Excalibur. Let me see this.
Yeah, that's sad about that whole situation. Hopefully they'll be back on.
And things like Banana Convention and their transformation. Started out really kind of as a satiric group, Bubblegum. And they were more than that from the very beginning, but now they're really expressing their true selves. They're rocking and they're just a great band. I think Ray Torres had something to do with it, though he's not with me anymore. It's something to do with their shift, and it was a positive shift. And I think they're just a wonderful band. They know what to do. They're intelligent, so they have great marketing.
Right.
And they can go on tour.
That's Monty. He's
Monty.
Something else.
Oh, yeah. And they get these street teams across the country where they go, and they always make a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
That inspired me to, whenever I book out-of-town bands, is, do you have a street team? Can you give me posters? Can you give me CDs? Do you know people?
Do you have merch that you're going to make ends meet with this?
Yeah, and so it's like when Sprout toured, they didn't have that set up. And what they told me was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be careful of that kind of stuff. If you're living hand to mouth on the road and not making money, you could get stranded, for God's sakes. You know?
Been there, done it.
Yeah.
It's ugly. It's not fun.
Yeah. I don't know. There's people that I really like. Lauren Kranz. He's going to do some solo stuff. He's going to rotate with Aaron on Sundays. We got Don. And that's one thing about White Sprite. Started was these afternoon shows, 5 to 9 shows.
Yeah.
So we have Don Zazula, Corn Pone, Zydeco Ziggy, Lauren Kranz doing the afternoon shows. And I think it has potential.
Yeah, I like that. People want, you know, it's the thing is that people put money in the jukebox anyway when there's not music playing, so they might as well have something mellow going on, you know.
Yeah.
And if it's not about money, then cool. Let's have someone play, you know.
I like rockabilly too, and so bands like Castle Rock and Dominic Daddies and Triple Aces, I like to have them around because I like those original rhythms of as rock and roll started to change or become itself. There's several versions of rock and roll, and that was one of them.
Right.
And there's the 60s stuff, which changed rock and roll.
There seems to be a pulse of rockabilly in Michigan, too, or at least Southeast Michigan. There's a fan base for it.
Yeah, there is. And in fact, I tried to get a hold of Jack Scott. And he's the guy that introduced rock, and it was really rockabilly, to Detroit. He opened up the Detroit market. He's given credit for that. He's like 70 now. And I wanted him to play White Spar. And the funny thing, you don't have to write this, but the funny thing is, years ago I contacted him, and his son-in-law was the agent, no longer the son-in-law. He left.
Yeah.
And it was like $1,500. And so I called him just about a week ago or so. And I talked to his wife, Bobby, and about outdoor show, and she was all for it. And I says, well, what's the price? And she goes, $3,500. And I go, well, you know, a few years back, I talked to Jack's son-in-law, and he said $1,500. I tried to get it down to a grand. And she says, that couldn't have been. Well, it was.
Right.
I didn't talk to Bobby back then. I talked to Jack's son-in-law. But, and so, I don't know, maybe his price went up as he aged.
Yeah, maybe it's going up yearly now.
You know, I saw him, let me see, was it 200th anniversary of Detroit being founded or something?
Mm-hmm.
Stevie Wonder played, and it was a weekend. My wife and I got a hotel room and spent the weekend there. And we saw Jack play, and he was wonderful. And then all kinds of great bands played during that weekend. But then when Stevie Wonder came on, a huge influx, overwhelmed, and my wife and I got cut off. People were screaming and crying, fighting. I thought there'd be a trample because it was people were getting hysterical. That was never on the news. It scared the piss out of me.
Right. When was this?
It was... When did they have that celebration? Like 4 years ago?
Yeah, it wasn't long ago.
It wasn't long ago. And we spent the whole weekend. It was great until the finale of Stevie Wonder. And he's too big for Little Heart Plaza.
And it was a free show, wasn't it?
All free.
Yeah, so it's like you got people from, 700,000 Detroit residents trying to get in there to see Stevie play, you know, their native son.
And they ship people to the stadium or something? And so people would watch a closed-circuit TV from the stadium.
Oh.
And my wife and I were being crunched, and I found her, thank God, but I was afraid she was being trampled. And people, so what we did, we left. I went up to the police guy and I said, listen, crowd's getting kind of out of control. Somebody could get hurt.
Right.
And they just looked at me. Oh, fuck you, you know. And we went to our hotel.
Mm-hmm.
We were shaken by the circumstances, and we had to recover.
Mm-hmm.
We went back out later, but it was like, I gotta get safe.
Right.
And then we turned on the TV to see if there was coverage because I thought there would be a stampede by then.
Right. Yeah, that happens down there. Herbie Hancock played a free show during the Jazz Fest a couple years ago. Was it 1 or 2 years ago? Same thing. Well, when Herbie Hancock, probably the greatest living jazz pianist, plays a free show in Detroit of all places, you know, where jazz, you know, one of the roots of jazz is in Detroit.
Yes, yes. Oh.
Imagine that. I mean.
And you were caught in it?
No, I wasn't there, but I heard about it. And it was the same deal. I wish I could have gone.
Well, Tom, I should probably get it.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
This is great. I probably have this. It might be a few weeks before this goes up, but.
Well, I rambled. I